MacDonald Fraser. This full-length reading of the Flashman series by George MacDonald Fraser was recorded by arrangement with Dutton Signet, a division of Penguin Books USA, Incorporated, and was produced in 1995 by Books on Tape, Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Neither this recording nor any part thereof may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authority from Books on Tape, Incorporated. This book is read by David Case. Please observe the following procedures as you listen to these tapes. If you have borrowed this book from your local library, please return it to them at the end of the agreed period. If you are one of our regular rental customers, you may keep your book for 30 days from date of receipt by you, but after that time we charge additional rental of 25 cents per day. Dates are checked by postmark. Please return this book at the earliest possible time, so another subscriber can have the use of this recording. To return cassettes to us, simply make sure they're all packaged in their plastic cassette cases and in proper order in the mailing container. Kindly seal the mailing container for return. Postage is already paid. Drop in any mailbox for return to Books on Tape. Should a cassette fail to play properly, hold it flat in the palm of your hand and slap it smartly against a hard, flat surface. If this does not work, or if you cannot otherwise free the reels, and if you're a library customer, please ask your local library to contact Books on Tape for a replacement cassette. If you are one of our rental customers, please call us at our regular customer service number, give us the name of the book and number of the cassette. We will immediately send you a replacement at no charge. Discard the broken cassette. Flashman and the Redskins by George MacDonald Fraser. This book consists of 21 chapters and is 448 pages long. The following material appears on the dust jacket of the book. If the American West was a place for heroes, what then was Harry Flashman doing there? Among other things, he was fleeing a murder charge, travelling with a brothel on wheels towards the California goldfields, betraying the scarlet woman who loved him, tricking the noble red men while seducing their women, studiously ignoring all calls of duty and honour as he dealt with the likes of Wild Bill Hickok, Geronimo, Kit Carson, Crazy Horse, and George Custer, and reaching his moment of supreme inglory and fear under fire at the Battle of Little Bighorn. Yes, Flashman was back in the thick of things, making the kind of history you will never learn in school. About the author. George MacDonald Fraser was born in England, schooled in Scotland, and now lives with his family on the Isle of Man. He is the author of Flashman, Royal Flash, Flash for Freedom, Flashman at the Charge, Flashman in the Great Game, The Pirates, and Flashman's Lady. The first seven volumes of the Flashman papers, to which Flashman and the Redskins is the latest highly acclaimed edition. The book is preceded by an explanatory note. A singular feature of the Flashman papers, the memoirs of the notorious bully of Tom Brown's schooldays, which were discovered in a Leicestershire saleroom in 1966, is that their author wrote them in self-contained instalments, describing his background and setting the scene anew each time. This has been of great assistance to me in editing the papers entrusted to me by Mr. Paget Morrison of Durban, Flashman's closest legitimate relative. It has meant that as I opened each new packet of manuscript, I could expect the contents to be a complete and self-explanatory book, needing only a brief preface and footnotes. Six volumes have followed this pattern. The seventh volume has proved to be an exception. It follows chronologically, to the very minute, onto the third packet, published in 1971 under the title Flash for Freedom, with only the briefest preamble by its aged author. I have therefore felt it necessary to append a resume of the third packet at the end of this note, so that new readers will understand the events leading up to Flashman's seventh adventure. It was obvious from the early papers that Flashman, in the intervals of his distinguished and scandalous service in the British Army, visited America more than once. This seventh volume is his Western Odyssey, I believe it is unique. Others may have taken part in both the 49 Gold Rush and the Battle of the Little Bighorn, but they have not left records of these events, nor did they have Flashman's close, if reluctant, acquaintance with three of the most famous Indian chiefs, as well as with leading American soldiers, frontiersmen, and statesmen of the time, of whom he has left vivid, and it may be revealing, portraits. As with his previous memoirs, I believe his truthfulness is not in question. As students of those volumes will be aware, his personal character was deplorable, his conduct abandoned, and his talent for mischief apparently inexhaustible. Indeed, his one redeeming feature was his unblushing veracity as a memorialist. As I hope the footnotes and appendices will show, I have been at pains to check his statements wherever possible, and I am indebted to librarians, custodians, and many members of the great and kindly American public at Santa Fe, Albuquerque, Minneapolis, Fort Laramie, the Custer Battlefield, the Yellowstone and Arkansas Rivers, and Bent's Fort. GMF. There then follows an introduction. In May 1848, Flashman was forced to flee England after a card scandal and sailed for Africa on the Balliol College, a ship owned by his father-in-law, John Morrison of Paisley, and commanded by Captain John Charity Spring, M.A., late fellow of Oriel College. Only too late did Flashman discover that the ship was an illegal slave trader, and her captain, despite his academic antecedents, a homicidal eccentric. After taking aboard a cargo of slaves in Dahomey, the Balliol College crossed the Atlantic, but was captured by the American Navy. Flashman managed to escape in New Orleans and took temporary refuge in a bawdy house, whose proprietress, a susceptible English matron named Susan Willink, was captivated by his picaresque charm. Thereafter, Flashman spent several eventful months in the Mississippi Valley, frequently in headlong flight. For a time, he impersonated, among many other figures, a Royal Navy officer. He was also a reluctant agent of the Underground Railroad, which smuggled escaped slaves to Canada. But unfortunately, the fugitive entrusted to his care was recognized by a vindictive planter named Omohundro, and Flashman abandoned his charge and beat a hasty retreat over the rail of a steamboat. He next obtained employment as a plantation slave driver, but lost his position on being found in compromising circumstances with his master's wife. He subsequently stole a beautiful octoroon slave, Cassie, sold her under a false name, assisted her subsequent evasion, and with the proceeds of the sale fled with her across the ice floes of the Ohio River, pursued by slave catchers who shot him in the buttock. However, he succeeded in effecting his escape, and Cassie's, with the timely assistance of the then congressman, Abraham Lincoln. With charges of slave trading, slave stealing, false pretenses, and even murder hanging over his head, Flashman was now anxious to return to England. Instead, mischance brought him again to New Orleans, and he was driven in desperation to seek the help of his former commander, Captain Spring, who had been cleared of slave trading by a corrupt American court and was about to sail. Flashman, who throughout his misfortunes had clung tenaciously to certain documents from the Balliol College, documents proving the ship's slaving activities, with which Flashman had hoped to blackmail his detested father-in-law, now offered them as the price of his passage home. Captain Spring, his habitual malevolence tempered by his eagerness to secure papers so dangerous to himself, agreed. At this point, with our exhausted narrator quaking between the Scylla of United States justice and Charybdis in the person of the diabolic Spring, the third packet of the Flashman papers ended, and the next chapter of his American adventure begins. The 49er. Chapter 1.
I never did learn to speak Apache properly. Mind you, it ain't easy, mainly because the red brute seldom stands still long enough. And if you've any sense, you don't either, or you're liable to find yourself studying their system of vowel pronunciation. Which is unique, by the way. while hanging head down over a slow fire or riding for dear life across the Jornada del Muerto with them howling at your heels and trying to stick lances in your liver. Both of which predicaments I've experienced in my time, and you may keep them. Still, it's odd that I never got my tongue round it, for apart from fleeing and fornication, slinging the bat is my strongest suit.
Speaking the local language, British Army slang.
Well, I speak 9 languages better than the natives, and can rub along in another dozen or so. And I knew the Apaches well enough, God help me. I was even married to one for a spell. Bands, beads, buffalo dance and all. And a spanking little wild beast she was, too, with her peach-brown satin skin and hot black eyes, and those white doe-skin leggings up to her thighs with the tiny silver bells all down the sides. I can close my eyes and hear them tinkling yet, 60 years after, and feel the pine needles under my knees, and smell the wood smoke mingling with the musky perfume of her hair, and the scent of the wild flowers outside her bower. The soft lips teasing my ear, murmuring, "Make my bells ring again, Pindalikoyi."
Literally white eye, a white man.
Aye, me, it's a long time ago. But that's the way to learn a language, if you like, in between the sighs and squeals. And if it didn't happen in this case, the reason is that my buxom savage was not only a great chief's daughter, but Mexican Hidalgo on her mother's side, and inclined to put on airs something peculiar, such as speaking only Spanish in preference to the tribal dialect of the common herd. They can be just as pert and hoity-toity in a Mimbreno wiki-up as they can in a Belgravia drawing-room, believe me. Fortunately, there's a cure. But that's beside the point for the moment. Even if my Apache never progressed far beyond Nuechichi Itzan, which may be loosely translated as "Come here, girl," and is all you need to know, apart from a few fawning protestations of friendship and whines for mercy, and much good they'll do you, I still recognize the diabolical lingo when I hear it. That guttural hissing mumble with all its z and zl and r noises, like a drunk Scotch Jew having trouble with his false teeth, is something you don't forget in a hurry. So when I heard it in the Travellers a few weeks ago and had mastered an instinctive impulse to dive for the door boiling, "Pash, ride for it, you fellows, and save your hair," I took stock and saw that it was coming in a great spate from a pasty-looking specimen with a lordly academic voice and some 3/8 order on his shirt front who was enthralling a group of toadies in a corner of the smoking room. I demanded to know what the devil he meant by it, and he turned out to be some distinguished anthropologist or other who'd been lecturing to the Royal Geographic on North American Indians. "And what do you know about them apart from that beastly chatter?" says I, pretty warm, for he had given me quite a start, and I could see at a glance that he was one of these snoopopathic meddlers who strut about with a fly-whisker notebook, prodding lies out of the niggers and over-tipping the dragoman on college funds. He looked taken aback until they told him who I was, and that I had a fair acquaintance with North American Indians myself, to say nothing of other various aborigines. At that, he gave me a distant, flabby hand and condescended to ask me an uneasy question or two about my American travels. I told him I'd been out with Terry and Custer in 76, and that was as far as I got before he said, "Oh, indeed," down his nose, damn chilly, showed me his shoulder and began the most infernal prose you ever heard to the rest of the company, all about the Yankees' barbarous treatment of the Plains tribes after the uprising, and their iniquitous Indian policy in general, the abominations of the reservation system, and the cruelties practiced in the name of civilization on helpless nomads, who desired only to be left alone to pursue their traditional way of life as peaceful herdsmen, fostering their simple culture, honoring their ancient gods, and generally prancing about like fawns in Arcady. Mercifully, I hadn't had dinner. "Noble savages, eh?" says I, when he'd paused for breath, and he gave me a look full of sentimental spite. "I might call them that," snaps he. "Do I take it that you would disagree?" Depends which ones you're talking about, says I. Now, Spotted Tail was a gentleman. Chico Velasquez, on the other hand, was an evil, vicious brute. But you probably never met either of them. Care for a brandy, then? He went pink. I thank you, no. By gentleman, I suppose, he went on, bristling. You mean one who is despaired to the point of submission. While brute would no doubt describe any sturdy, independent patriot who resisted the injustice of an alien rule or revolted against broken treaties. If sturdy independence consists of cutting off women's fingers and fringing your buckskins with them, then Chico was a patriot, no error, says I. Mind you, that was the soft end of his behaviour. Hey, waiter, another one, and keep your thumb out of it, yeah? My new acquaintance was going still pinker and taking in breath. He wasn't used to the argumentum ad Chico Velasquez, and it was plainly getting his goat, as I intended it should. Barbarism is to be expected from a barbarian, especially when he's been provoked beyond endurance. He snorted and sneered. Really, sir, will you seriously compare errant brutality committed by this Velasquez, as you call him, who by his name, I take it, sprang from that unhappy Pueblo stock who had been brutalized by centuries of Spanish atrocity? Will you compare it, I say, with a calculated policy of suppression? Nay, extermination, devised by a modern Christian government? You talk of an Indian savagery? Yet you boast acquaintance with General Custer, and doubtless you have heard of Chivington, Sand Creek, sir, Wounded Knee, Washita. Ah, you see, cries he in triumph, I can quote your own lexicon to you. In face of that, will you dare condone Washington's treatment of the American Indian?
I don't condone it, says I, holding my temper, and I don't condemn it either. It happened just as the tide comes in, and since I saw it happen, I know better than to jump to the damn fool sentimental conclusions that are fashionable in college cloisters, let me tell you.
There were cries of protest, and my anthropologist began to gobble. Fashionable indeed! Have you read Mrs. Jackson, sir? Are you ignorant of the miserable condition to which a proud and worthy people have been reduced? Since you served in the Sioux campaign, you cannot be unaware of the callous and vindictive zeal with which it and subsequent expeditions were conducted against a resistless foe. Can you defend the extirpation of the Modocs, or the Apaches, or a dozen others I could mention? For shame, sir!
He was getting the bit between his teeth now, and I was warming just a trifle myself.
And all this at a time when the resource of a vast modern state might have been employed in a policy of humanity, restraint, and enlightenment. But no, all the dark old prejudices and hatreds must be given full and fearful rein, and the despised hostile annihilated or reduced to virtual serfdom.
He gestured contemptuously.
And all you can say is that it happened? Tush, sir. So might Pilate have said, it happened.
He was pleased with that, so he enlarged on it.
The Procurator of Judea would have made a fit aide-de-camp to your General Terry, I dare say. I wish you a very good night, General Flashman.
Which would have enabled him to stalk off with the honours, but I don't abandon an argument when reason persuasion may prevail. Now see here, you mealy little pimp, says I. I've had just about a bellyful of your pious hypocritical maundering. Take a look at this. And while he gobbled again and his sycophants uttered shocked cries, I dropped my head and pulled apart my top hair for his inspection. See that bald patch? That, my industrious researcher, was done by a Brule scalping knife in the hand of a peaceful herdsman, to a man who'd done his damnedest to see that the Brules and everyone else in the Dakota Nation got a fair shake. Which was a gross exaggeration, but never mind that.
So much for humanity and restraint. Good God! Cries he, blenching. Very well, sir, you may flaunt a wound. It does not prove your case. Rather, it explains your partiality.
It proves that at least I know what I'm talking about. Which is more than you can say. As to Custer, he's receipted and filed for the idiot he was. And for Chivington, he was a murderous maniac.
and what's worse, an amateur. But if you think they were a whit more guilty than your darling redskins, you're an even bigger bloody fool than you look. What bleating breast-beaters like you can't comprehend, I went on at the top of my voice while the toadies poured at me and yapped for the porters, is that when selfish, frightened men, in other words, any men, red or white, civilized or savage, come face to face in the middle of a wilderness that both of them want, the Lord alone knows why, then war breaks out and the weaker goes under. Policies don't matter a spent piss. It's the men in fear and rage and uncertainty watching the woods and skylines, you see. You purblind bookworm, you. And you burble about enlightenment, my God.
Catch hold of his other arm, Fred, says the porter, heaving away. Come along now, General, if you please.
Try to enlighten a Comanche war party. Why don't you? Suggest humanity and restraint to the Hickorillas who carved up Mrs. White and her baby on Rock Creek. Have you ever seen a Del Norte rancho after the Membranos have left their calling cards? No, not you, you plush bottom bastard, you. All right, Stuart, I'm going, damn you. But let me tell you, I concluded, and I dare say I may have shaken my finger at the academic squirt, who had got behind a chair and was looking ready to bolt, that I've a damn sight more use for the Indian than you have, as much as I have for the rest of humanity at all events, and I don't make him an excuse for parading my own virtue while not caring a fig for them as you do. So there, I know your sort. Broken treaties, you vain blot. Why, Chico Velasquez wouldn't have recognized a treaty if he'd fallen over it in the dark.
But by that time I was out in Pall Mall addressing the vault of heaven.
Who the hell ever said the Washington government was Christian anyway?
I demanded. But the porter said he really couldn't say, and did I want a cab? You may wonder that I got in such a taking over one pompous windbag spouting claptrap. Usually I just sit and sneer when the know-alls start prating on behalf of the poor oppressed heathen, sticking a barb in them as opportunity serves. Why, I've absolutely heard them lauding the sepoy mutineers as honest patriots, and I haven't even bothered to break wind by way of dissent. I know the heathen and their oppressors pretty well, you see, and the folly of sitting smug in judgment years after, stuffed with piety and ignorance and book-learned bias. Humanity is beastly and stupid, aye, and helpless, and there's an end to it. And that's as true for Crazy Horse as it was for Custer, and they're both long gone, thank God. But I draw the line at the likes of my anthropological half-truther. Oh, there's a deal in what he says, right enough, but it's only one side of the tale. And when I hear it puffed out with all that righteous certainty, as though every white man was a villain, and every redskin a saint, and the fools swallow it and feel suitably guilty, well, it can get my goat. Especially if I've got a drink in me and my kidneys are creaking. So, I'm slung out of the Travellers for ungentlemanly conduct. Much I care. I wasn't a member anyway. A waste of good passion, of course. The thing is, I suppose, that while I spent most of my time in the West skulking and running and praying to God I'd come out with a whole skin, I have a strange sentiment for the place even now. That may surprise you if you know my history. Old Flashy, the decorated hero and cowardly venal scoundrel who never had a decent feeling in all his scandalous, lecherous life. Aye, but there's a reason, as you shall see. Besides, when you've seen the West almost from the beginning, as I did, trader, wagon captain, bounty hunter, irregular soldier, whoremaster, gambler, scout, Indian fighter, well, being armed in the presence of the enemy qualifies you, even if you don't tarry long. And reluctant deputy marshal to J.B. Hickok, Esquire, no less, you're bound to retain an interest, even in your 89th year. And it takes just a little thing, a drift of wood smoke, a certain sunset, the taste of maple syrup on a pancake, or a few words of Apache spoken unexpected,
and I can see the wagons creaking down to the Arkansas crossing, and the piano stuck fast on a mud bank, with everyone laughing while Susie played banjo on my knee. Old Glory fluttering above the gated fence, the hideous zeep of Navajo war arrows through canvas, the great bison herds in the distance spreading like oil on the yellow plain, the crash and stamp of fandango with the poblanas' heels clicking and their silk skirts whirling above their knees, the bearded faces of Galantine's riders in the fire globe, the air like nectar when we rode in the spring from the high glory of Eagle Nest up under the towering white peaks to Fort St. Vrain and Laramie. The incredible stink of those dark dripping forms in the Apache sweat bath at Santa Rita. The great scarred Cheyenne braves with their slanting feathers, riding stately like kings to council. The sweet sullen lips whispering, "Make my bells ring again." Oh, yes indeed, ma'am. And the nightmare, the screams and shots and war whoops, as Gaul's hunk papa horde came surging through the dust, and George Custer squatting on his heels, his cropped head in his hands, as he coughed out his life, and the red and yellow devil's face screaming at me from beneath the buffalo's scalp helmet as the hatchet drove down at my brow. "Well, boys, they killed me," as Wild Bill used to say. Only it wasn't permanent, and today I sit at home in Berkeley Square staring out at the trees beyond the railings in the rain, damning the cramp in my pen hand, and remembering where it all began, on a street in New Orleans in 1849, with your humble obedient trotting anxiously at the heels of John Charity Spring, M.A., Oriole Man, slaver, and homicidal lunatic, who was stamping his way down to the quay in a fury, jacket buttoned tight and hat jammed down, alternately blaspheming and quoting Horace. "I should have dropped you over Bord of Finisterre," snarls he. "It would have been the price of you, but God. Aye, well, I missed my chance. Quando que bonus dormitat Homerus." Even good Homer nods sometimes. That is, even the cleverest can make mistakes. He wheeled on me suddenly, and those dreadful pale eyes would have frozen brandy. "But Homer won't nod again, Mr. Flashman, and you can lay to that. One false step out of you this trip, and you wish the Amazons had got you." "Captain," says I earnestly, "I'm as anxious to get out of this as you are, and you've said it yourself. How can I play you false? If I knew that, I'd be as dirty a little Judas as you are." He considered me balefully. "The more I think of it, the more I like the notion of having those papers of Comer's before we go a step farther." Now those papers, which implicated both Spring himself and my miserly Scotch father-in-law up to their necks in the illegal slave trade, were the only card in my hand. Once Spring had them, he could drop me overboard indeed. Terrified as I was, I shook my head, and he showed his teeth in a sneering grin. "What are you scared of, you worm? I've said I'll carry you home, and I keep my word. By God," he growled, and the scar on his brow started to swell crimson, a sure sign that he was preparing to howl at the moon. "Will you dare say I don't, you quaking offal? Will you? No, you'd better not. Why, you fool, I'll have him within 5 minutes of your setting foot on my deck, in any event, because you're carrying them, aren't you? You wouldn't dare leave him out of your sight. I know you." He grinned again nastily. "Omnia mea mecum porto. I carry all my things with me, as your style. Where are they? In your coat lining or under your boot sole?" It was no consolation that they were in neither, but sewn in the waistband of my pants. He had me, and if I didn't want to be abandoned there and then to the mercy of the Yankee law, which was after me for murder, slave stealing, impersonating a naval officer, false pretenses, theft of a wagon and horses, perjury, and issuing false bills of sale, Christ, just about everything except bigamy. I had no choice but to fork out and hope to heaven he'd keep faith with me. He saw it in my face and sneered. As I thought, you're as easy to read as an open book, and a vile publication, too. We'll have them now, if you please.
He jerked his thumb at a tavern across the street.
Come on! Captain, for God's sake, let it wait till we're aboard. The Yankee Navy traps will be scouring the town for me by now. Please, Captain, I swear you'll have them.
Do as you're damn well told,
he rasped. And seizing my arm in an iron hand, he almost ran me into the pub and thrust me into a corner seat farthest from the bar. It was middling dim, with only one or two swells lounging at the tables, and a few of the merchant and trader sort talking at the bar, but just the kind of respectable ken that my legal and naval acquaintances might frequent. I pointed this out, whining.
5 minutes more or less won't hurt you, says Spring. And they'll satisfy me whether or not you're breaking the habit of a lifetime by telling the truth for once.
So while he bawled for juleps and kicked the black waiter for being dilatory, I wish to God he wouldn't attract attention with his high table manners. I kept me back to the room and began surreptitiously picking stitches out of my flies with a penknife. He drummed impatiently, growling, while I got the packet out, that precious sheaf of flimsy, close-written papers that Comer had died for, and he pored through it, grinding his teeth as he read.
That ingrate, sanctimonious reptile! He should have lingered for a year. I was like a father to the bastard, and see how he repaid my benevolence, by God, skulking and spying like a rat at a scuttle. But you're all alike, you shabby, genteel vermin. Aye, Master Comer, Phaedrus limned your epitaph. Saepe interiunt aliis meditantes necem. And serve the bastard right.
Those who plot the destruction of others often destroy themselves.
He stuffed the papers into his pocket, drank, and brooded at me with that crazy glint in his eyes that I remembered so well from the Balliol College. And you held on to them. Why? To steer me into execution. Duck you! Never! I protested. Why, if I'd wanted to, I could have done it back in the court, but I didn't, did I? And put your own foul neck in a noose, not you.
He gave his barking laugh.
No, I'll make a shrewd guess that you are keeping him to squeeze an income out of that Scotch miser Morrison. That was it, wasn't it?
Mad he might be, but his wits were sharp enough.
Filial piety, you leper. Well, if that was your game, you're out of luck. He's dead, and certainly damned. I had word from our New York agent 3 weeks ago. That takes your flutter back, doesn't it, my bucko?
And it did, but only for a moment, for if I couldn't turn the screw on a corpse, well, I didn't need to, did I? The little villain's fortune would descend to his daughters, of whom my lovely simpleton wife Elspeth was the favourite. By George, I was rich. He'd been worth a cool 2 million, they reckoned, and at least a quarter would come to her, and me, unless the wily old skinflint had cooked up some legal flummery to keep my paws off it, as he'd done these 10 years past. But he couldn't. Elspeth must inherit. And I could twist her around my little finger, couldn't I? She'd always doted on me, although I had a suspicion that she sampled the marriage mutton elsewhere when my back was turned. I couldn't be sure, though. And anyway, an occasional unwifely romp was no great matter while she'd been dependent on Papa. But now, when she was rolling in blunt, she might be off whoring with all hands and the cook, and too much of that might well damp her ardour for an absent husband. Who could say how she'd greet the returning Odysseus now that she was filthy rich and spoiled for choice? That apart, if I knew my fair feather brain, she'd be spending the dibs, my dibs, like a drunk duke on his birthday. The sooner I was home, the better, but Morrison kicking the bucket was capital news just the same.
Spring was watching me as he watched the weather, shrewd and sour, and knowing what a stickler he could be for proper form, murderous pirate though he was, I tried to put on a solemn front and muttered about the unexpected blow, shocking calamity, irreplaceable loss, and all the rest of it. "I can see that," he scoffed. "Stricken with grief, I dare say. I know the signs. A face like a Tyneside winter and a damned inheriting gleam in your eye. Bah! Why don't you blubber, you hypocritical pup? Nulli jactantius moerent, quam qui loitantur." None mourn with more affectation of sorrow than those who are inwardly rejoiced. "Or, to give Tacitus a free translation, you're reckoning up the bloody dollars already. Well, you haven't got 'em yet, Cully, and if you want to see London Bridge again," and he bared his teeth at me, "you'll tread mighty delicate, like Agag, and keep on the weather side of John Charity's spring." "What do you mean? I've given you the papers. You're bound to see me safe." "Oh, I'll do that, never fear." There was a cunning shift in those awful, empty eyes. "Me duce tutus eris." "With me for your leader, you will be safe, Ovid. And do you know why? Because when you reach England, and you and the rest of Morrison's carrion brood have got your claws on his fortune, you'll discover that you need an experienced director for his extensive maritime concerns, lawful and otherwise." He grinned at me triumphantly. "You'll pay through the nose for him too, but you'll be getting a safe, scholarly man of affairs who'll not only manage your fleet, but can be trusted to see that no indiscreet inquiries are ever directed at your recent American activities, or the fact that your signature as supercargo is to be found on the articles of a slave trader." "Christ, look who's talking!" I exclaimed. "I was shanghaied, kidnapped. And what about you? Damn your eyes, will you take that tone with me?" He roared, and a few heads at the nearest table turned, so he dropped his voice to its normal snarl. "English law holds no terrors for me. I'll be in Brest or Calais, taking my money in francs and guilders, thanks to those misbegotten scum of ushers at Oxford, who cast me into the gutter out of spite, who robbed me of dignity and the fruits of scholarship." His scar was crimsoning again, as it always did when Oxford was mentioned. Oriel had kicked him out, you see, no doubt for purloining the college plate or strangling the dean, but he always claimed it was academic jealousy. He writhed and growled and settled down. "England holds nothing for me now, but your whole future lies there, and there'll be damned little future if the truth about this past year comes out. The army? Disgrace. Your newfound fortune? Ruin. You might even swing," says he, smacking his lips. "And your lady wife would certainly find the social entree more difficult to come by. On which score," he added malevolently, "I wonder how she would take the news that her husband is a whore-mongering rake who covered everything that moved aboard the Balliol College. By and large, mutual discretion will be in both our interests, don't you think?" And the evil lunatic grinned at me sardonically and drained his glass. "We'll have leisure to discuss business on the voyage home, and to resume your classical education, whose interruption by those meddling Yankee Navy bastards, I'm sure you deploy as much as I do. Hiatus valde de Flanders, a want greatly to be deplored, as I seem to remember telling you before. Now, get that drink into you, and we'll be off." As I've said, he was really mad. If he thought he could blackmail me with his ridiculous threats, and him a discredited don turned pirate who'd be clapped into bedlam as soon as he opened his mouth in civilized company, he was well out of court. But I knew better than to say so just then. Waving or not, he was my one hope of getting out of that beastly country.
and if I had to endure his interminable proses about Horace and Ovid all across the Atlantic, so be it. I drank up meekly, pushed back my chair, turned to the room, and walked slap into a nightmare. It was the most ordinary, trivial thing, and it changed the course of my life, as such things do. Perhaps it killed Custer. I don't know. As I took my first step from the table, a tall man standing at the bar roared with laughter and stepped back, just catching me with his shoulder. Another instant and I'd have been past him unseen. But he jostled me and turned to apologize. "Your pardon, sir," says he, and then his eyes met mine and stared, and for full 3 seconds we stood frozen in mutual recognition, for I knew that face, the coarse whiskers, the scarred cheek, the prominent nose and chin, and the close-set eyes. I knew it before I remembered his name, Peter Omohundro. Chapter 2. You all know these embarrassing little encounters, of course. The man you borrowed money off, or the chap whose wife has flirted with you, or the people whose invitation you've forgotten, or the vulgarian who accosts you in public. Omohundro wasn't quite like these exactly. The last time we'd met, I'd been stealing one of his slaves, and shots had been flying, and he'd been roaring after me with murder in his eye, while I'd been striking out for the Mississippi shore. But the principle was the same, and so I flatter myself was my immediate behaviour. I closed my mouth, murmured an apology, nodded offhand, and made to pass on. I've known it work, but not with this indelicate bastard. He let out an appalling oath and seized my collar with both hands. "Prescott!" he bawled. "By God, Prescott!" "I beg your pardon, sir," says I, damn stiff. "I haven't the honour of your acquaintance." "Haven't you, though, you nigger-stealing son of a bitch? I sure as hell got the honour of yours. Jim, get a constable, quick, damn it. Why, you thieving varmint!" And while they gaped in astonishment, he thrust me by main strength against the wall, pinning me there and roaring to his friends, "It's Prescott, underground railroader that stole away George Randolph from the Sultana last year. Hold still, goddamn you. It's him, I say. Here, Will, catch hold of t'other arm. Now, you dog, you, hold still there, you." "You're wrong," I cried. "I'm someone else. You've got the wrong man," I say. "My name's not Prescott. Get your confounded hands off me."
This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette. Please reverse or turn the cassette over now.